Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now please join me in welcoming my regular co-host, a man who takes yoga every day with Rahm Emanuel, Rick Hess.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
I'm good. How are you doing, man?
Good, man. That yoga keeps me stretched, especially like them pilates.
Pilates. Oh, that was a good one. I like that, Rick. So, I haven't paying a lot of attention to the news lately because I've been working on a book and very focused. But I came into town today to decide I should just take a peek at the Post and the New York Times, kind of see what's going on. Mm. And all the hubbub is about Barack Obama's pickup basketball games mm-hmm. and how he's not including women in those. And how, everybody knows there's this whole bonding that goes on around sports and mm-hmm. the president. And yet Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff, not in that inner circle mm-hmm. because he likes yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to be a ballet dancer mm-hmm. like you.
And because his finger got messed up.
What happened to his finger?
He's missing part of a finger.
How'd that happen?
I don't know. I think he was taking the rock to the hole against the Prez.
Yeah.
Boom.
Ooh.
Obama sent him reject. Part of his finger skittered across the White House lawn.
Ouch.
That dog, was it Cujo, ate it? Well, not Cujo.
What's the hyperallergenic dog.
Yeah. He's hyperallergenic because he ate Emanuel's finger. It was apparently the passerby on Constitution uh-huh. were all shocked.
Shocked.
Two kids mm-hmm. had to get counseling and therapy,
mm-hmm.
apparently.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So is this a big deal? I totally missed this. This is a big problem that Barack Obama's not being inclusive?
Oh, I thought you meant Emanuel's finger getting knocked off on the court.
Finger. Yeah, whatever.
Because he was in a bad mood at Pilates the other day because of it. He said, I'm missing my finger.
Yeah.
I said, hey, dude, these things happen.
Another thing that happened, this one is education related. Attorney General Eric Holder happened to see Kevin Chavis, former D.C. council member Kevin Chavis, at some kind of event. And he said, hey, Kevin, you got to stop running those ads that are blasting the president about D.C. vouchers.
Mm.
And some people take this as, unright intimidation from the attorney general. What do you think about this?
As opposed to not unwrite.
Sorry, I'm a little rusty. You would think somebody who spends the whole day writing would do better than that.
I had not heard about that.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't, they've been very careful to say, it wasn't an official administration thing. It's just, these guys, they know each other. They run into each other at some Washington.
Well, that seems better than the administration having an enemies list of the media.
Yeah.
So, in the scheme of things,
mm-hmm.
it's about what you'd expect nowadays.
Are we on that enemies list?
No, but I think Fox News is.
Yes, and in fact, I understand that there are people that secretly listen to the Education Gadfly Show from 400 Maryland Avenue. We know who you are, and we'll keep your secret safe. All right, we got a lot to cover. The whole regular crew is here today, our all-star A-team. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly mm-hmm. with Mickey, NPR voice Mickey. Then Amber is going to give us her research minute, and then Stafford's going to rate that reform. All of this as we sit around a video camera
Mike, I got to say, the famed Fordham Studios have gone to pot.
You want to know why? Because our soundboard broke. And you know why? Because we have been on the air for more than 3 years, and we have actually worn out a piece of equipment.
I'm not sure soundboard's supposed to get worn out from us talking into it at it or near it.
Because you're so freaking loud, it takes a lot of energy to tone it down. All right, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
I hope you guys sprang for some better equipment, man. I'm just saying.
Sometimes we think about springing for better hosts, too. Okay, Mickey, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Arne Duncan has given a number of speeches in the past week on teacher training and the need to make colleges of education more relevant and more effective. His department is investing in both colleges that are revamping their traditional programs and new residencies that will include much more classroom time for teachers and training. What do you think of the plans thus far?
I think he said some good things. I guess in the speech at the University of Virginia, I understand, he explicitly and publicly said, this is crazy that more people aren't studying with Don Hirsch. When I was at UVA, and your research director, Amber Winkler, was there, I remember Don Hirsch, Amber and I walked past his class one time. I think there was 5 students enrolled. I remember talking to Don about this back in those days, and he was just kind of, here he was, E.D. Hirsch, and graduate students and even undergraduates studying to be teachers simply weren't enrolling in his courses, which had a ton of room. So for Duncan to actually go down there, talk about this in public, raise the issue, that's terrific. It sounds like some of the notes he's hitting are strong and spirited. He's doing some throwaway language, which I could live without. The one thing I worry about here is all of this sounds, though, like they're thinking very much in terms of people going through pipelines, residency programs. There's not much here about how do we actually open this thing up, especially in those cases where we're not confident that much value is being added. I'd like to hear more said about that.
Well, I think, I mean, he certainly talks a lot about Teach for America and those sorts of alternatives. So he also talked about alternatives. Yeah, it's fine. I guess I'm growing just tired. It just seems like, yeah, it's very predictable. We know what he's going to say. He's going to give the reform line on ed schools. That's great. But I just worry about conventional wisdom creeping into this reform world. I mean, it's just the same old, same old. Mm. I mean, if we want to talk serious reform, let's talk about, I don't know, shutting down 3/4 of the nation's ed schools because they're terrible. Now, that would actually be, you know, somewhat radical. And that would drive us right into all kinds of difficult issues. You talk about, look, you know, a lot of the schools at the historically black colleges, the ed schools, you know, the kids are not passing the praxis tests because of, you know, we know about achievement gaps, we know about this long legacy. I mean, you face these issues head on, all of a sudden you're talking about, hey, you know, if kids can't pass this test, should they be in the classroom? What if that means you suddenly wipe out half your African-American or Latino teachers? Are you ready to take that one on? These are difficult, hard, painful, you know, politically charged issues. And, you know, I think the reform conventional wisdom has moved to a point where he can talk about a lot of this stuff that, you know, people wouldn't have talked about 10 years ago, but we're still not getting to the heart of it.
Well, and that's, you know, one, I mean, the problem with TFA is it's such a darn safe thing to endorse nowadays, TFA and TNTP. I'm a big fan, too, but it's, and the residency stuff is incredibly expensive. I mean, what I don't hear them talking about is ways to do this stuff more cost-effectively. Mm-hmm. What I hear is talking about stuff which the ed schools actually aren't all that uncomfortable with because it means more resources and more central role at the end of the day.
Okay, topic number two, Mickey.
Rhode Island Commissioner of Education Deborah Gist has been making big news recently, first by vowing to eliminate all seniority-based teacher assignment, and then by drastically raising cut scores needed to be admitted to the state's teacher prep programs. Commenter Whitney Tilson has been giving her extremely favorable coverage, even by his own standards, for these moves. Is the enthusiasm warranted?
Yeah, Whitney, I gotta love Whitney. Do you get his daily email?
No.
Oh, Rick, you're missing out. He gave this one, I don't know, 4 or 5 or maybe 6 exclamation points, all caps. Stop the presses!
Who is this guy? He's some New York investment banker guy?
Yeah, exactly. He's like a rich guy. He was friends with Wendy Kopp way back when. He bankrolls some TFA and KIPP stuff. But, you know, look, I mean, he is a bazillionaire of some sorts, but he's also a committed education reformer. Everywhere he goes, he visits a KIPP school. He's on the KIPP board. He gives school reform talks all over the place. I mean, he's very effective with other business leaders. Huge fan of Joel Klein, not a big fan of Diane Ravitch's and vice versa. Okay, enough about Whitney Tilson. Now about Deborah Gist. We know Deborah. She was here in D.C. running the State Department of Education in D.C. She's now in Rhode Island. Some gutsy moves. What got most attention this week was her saying that under some new law in Rhode Island, she viewed it that you could no longer do seniority transfers in schools. Pretty cool, pretty gutsy. I don't know if that'll stick. Gutsier, in my view, is her saying to her staff, hey, tell me who has the highest cut scores on praxis in the country. They came back and said Virginia, which we all know. She said, I want ours to be at least 1 point higher than Virginia's. And boom, she did it. Mm-hmm. This gets me back to what we were talking about before. I mean, she is going to now, it's going to be a lot harder to get through that gate gate in Rhode Island. And frankly, you can see the lawsuits now. That's going to have a, quote, disproportionate impact on minorities, probably because of the achievement gap, et cetera, et cetera. And there'll be an interesting debate about, you know, whether if we're going to say this generation of poor minority kids, does that mean saying that some minority teachers who can't pass those tests should not be in the classroom?
Yeah, but one of the things Deb shows, right, this is what she did in D.C. also around some of the tenure questions, is it shows how much commissioners and superintendents can do within the rules that are currently on the books and within the laws that exist. We keep hearing that we have to change these things for actions to get taken. Mm-hmm. Everything she's done in, what, 6 weeks now in office, a couple months, I can't remember now. Everything she's done is stuff that her predecessors were also empowered to do.
Mm-hmm. No, pretty cool. Hey, by the way, I want to be clear. I mean, because these issues are so sensitive. I know I'm not saying that all minority teachers in Rhode Island are going to fail this test, by no means, and nor are all white teachers going to pass the test.
You're just making good points.
But the point
is, being a little edgy, though.
What we've seen in Virginia, for example, is that when you have these high cut scores, you tend to have much higher failure rates among minority prospective teachers than among white teachers. All right, topic number three.
New York Governor David Paterson is feeling the heat from education reformers for his resistance to raising the state's cap on charter schools. Earlier in the month, many were also critical of New York Education Commissioner David Steiner's resistance on the same issue, and he's a card-carrying education reformer. So what, if any, are the sensible reasons to be cautious about raising the cap in the Empire State?
Well, not a lot come to my mind, Mike.
Well, no, I think there's an interesting question here. I mean, so New York has high-quality charter schools. It's also had a pretty strict cap. And the question is, are those two phenomena related? And there's reasons to believe that they are, that if you've got an environment where there's a limited number of caps and you have authorizers that actually want to see the charter school movement succeed, you know, you're forced into a situation where they know they have to be very careful and pick only the best applicants to go to scale. And that's not a terrible dynamic to have. We see in other places like Ohio, like Arizona, where there was a bit of a Wild West mentality. Anything goes, let a thousand flowers bloom. A lot of those flowers don't smell so good.
Nice. The other, I mean, it's a lot like New York City's taxi medallions, right? I mean, it's absolutely a way to control flow. One of the things that ensures in the New York charter space is that these are boutique operations, right? I mean, the enrollment percentage you're going to get to, even if you bump up the cap, you ensure that charter schooling is not going to be a tool of transformation, but is going to be a model of innovation, an incubator, all of these nice little cute things, but all of which ensure that charters don't really have a particularly transformative effect.
Yeah, but where have they had a transformative effect in places that don't have charter caps?
Nowhere.
I mean, so I don't find that a very compelling argument. Right? I mean, look, I think it's not a terrible policy to say, look, we're going to keep every few years looking at this issue and bumping up the cap, you know, instead of saying we're just going to get rid of the cap entirely. Now, sounds like New York is getting close to where they need that cap raised, and they should raise it. But
they need that cap raised.
Yeah. So that's fine. All right. But that doesn't make the argument that you should blow the cap out of the water entirely. I'm just saying, you know, let's keep going, you know, slow. That's not a crazy policy.
Like when we raise the federal debt limit, little by little, so you don't notice so much.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt
as
much.
I see.
The federal debt limit. Look at you. You're always trying to sneak in your little points here. Your predictive power and those kinds of researchy words. We have 1 minute for research, and it's here, everybody. Your favorite time of the show, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
How you doing?
What you got for us today, huh?
All right, we ready to jump in?
We're ready to jump in.
All right.
Jump.
This week we have a new nationally representative survey out from Public Agenda and Learning Point Associates. It's called Teaching for a Living. The researchers use a statistical technique called cluster analysis. Don't fall asleep on me. It groups data based on similar response patterns, and through this they came up with three distinct groups of teachers who all have different attitudes and concerns. They labeled them the disheartened, the idealist, and the contented. They found that 40% of teachers are disheartened, 37% are content, and 23% are idealistic. Unsurprisingly, the disheartened tend to be older and veterans. They are also more likely to cite lack of support from the administration as a major drawback to teaching. The contented group, on the other hand, are satisfied with their administrators, more likely to teach in middle-income or affluent schools, and to say that teaching is exactly what they want to do. Finally, the vast majority of idealists, most of whom are 32 or younger, say that good teachers can teach all students to learn, even those from poor, uninvolved families. Not so much with the other groups, however. Finally, and interestingly, similar percentages of idealists and discontented teachers teach in low-income schools. However, over two-thirds of idealists say working conditions are very good in those types of schools, but only a quarter of discontented teachers say the same. So it's possible that attitude is everything.
So, Amber, what did you learn from this thing?
I thought it was really neat. They kind of did a factor analysis, so they clumped, you know, they clumped mm-hmm. the responses together. And I think it showed some really interesting results. I mean, primarily that last one, which shows, you know, you've got discontented and idealists, which are TFA types, mm-hmm. are teaching in the same exact schools. And you've got, you know, these discontented people saying working conditions are terrible, my administrators don't support me, blah, blah. The idealists saying my administrators are supporting me, the working conditions are great. Mm-hmm. So what's going on here?
But shouldn't the survey be able to help us understand what was going on there?
Well, they didn't. I mean, it's not a case study interview. It's a survey, you know?
Look at you, Rick, always wanting more, I tell you.
Really?
So now, is your hypothesis here, Amber, that it is that they are just glasses half empty, glasses half full kind of people? Or is it that the administrators in those schools are supportive and do like the yeah. The aspirational teachers yeah, and actually are trying to make the other teachers miserable so they'll please leave.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no way to know that. But I mean, I think that, you know, the way that the sort of questions clumped together, it was pretty clear that idealists had a different mindset mm-hmm. you know, that they brought to the table in terms of, you know, their whole philosophy that kids, all kids can learn, you know, all this kind of, you know, rhetoric that these humanitarian TFA types bring to the table, we just don't see in other teachers who have been there for a
while. I wonder what percentage of disheartened teachers were once.
Right. I mean, what I'd like to see in all yeah. these teacher surveys is a longitudinal
That's
study.
Right.
If you could actually track individual teacher attitudes over time and find out if disheartened teachers were once idealist teachers that got mugged
Absolutely.
By reality. I also wonder, you know, the veteran teachers that end up in the high poverty schools.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know that there's all kinds of ways that many veteran teachers can get out of those schools if they want to, or if they are, you know, highly qualified and, you know, sought after. So maybe these teachers just aren't very good.
I mean, and the idealists, a third of them say they're going to leave and go into something else that's not teaching. So, you know, I mean, is it possible that you can only have that attitude and that enthusiasm for a few years and then you just lose it? I mean, I think that's possible.
You know, I feel like this dichotomy right now where the rhetoric of all children can learn no matter what's going on at home. I mean, I wish we could talk about it in a way that was more nuanced. If you're teaching, you know, kind of wealthy kids from well-educated families, you know, you could do yoga with them all day, back to Rick's hobby, and they'll still pass the reading and math tests, right? I mean, yeah, it's a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
You got kids coming from extreme poverty. You can be a phenomenal teacher, and you're gonna make a lot more progress than a not phenomenal teacher is gonna make. But there's still gonna be challenges.
Right.
I just wish we could. I just feel like this conversation is such that we don't have a good way of talking about this. Without being labeled as, giving into the soft bigotry of low expectations.
Well, your old administration certainly didn't help on this front.
No, we did not. You mean by calling people racist and things like that?
Yeah, you know, the entire state of Utah and Connecticut. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Thanks for not letting them forget that.
That's a fair point. Okay, Amber, so what's the song that goes along with
song,
these?
Since over half of teachers are content and happy, we have an upbeat little song by Aisha Woods called Happy.
I love it. How many? We should do a similar survey of education policy people and find out how many are disheartened, how many are idealistic, and how many are.
That worries me a little bit. I mean, I tend to think you go into any profession,
yes, yes.
You find that a third of people are excited about their work.
Right.
A third of people are fine.
Yeah.
And a third of people are annoyed.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how.
Yeah.
And how incisive that model is.
And look again. Well, the teaching thing too. I mean, you've got this group of teachers who are older. Who have to stick around because of the retirement system,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so you don't have that as badly in some other places.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly have it in other industries too, where people are waiting for that pension check.
But you have it at General Motors,
and they right.
Although
they
your idealistic faction nowadays is probably a lot smaller.
Probably a lot smaller.
The under 52s are the kids.
Yeah, not to mention the whole happy Saturn people that just got axed.
Right.
I feel bad. I used to own a Saturn. I'm just really torn up about the whole thing. Okay, but enough about that. It's time to rate that reform. Stafford, back in the Rate That Reform chair.
I am back in Rate That Reform. So there's been a lot of hype over the new collective bargaining agreement in New Haven. First of all, for the first time in many years, the union actually approved a contract without the help of binding arbitration or other forced tactics. Secondly, the contract makes many strides in areas of teacher evaluation performance, closing and reconstituting failing schools, and letting educators opt out of master contract stipulations to extend the school day or year, for example. But is this a huge breakthrough for collective bargaining agreements or just a baby step that's getting way too much attention? The short answer is both, and the long answer is a little bit more complicated. First of all, many of the details have not been hashed out or approved. The teacher evaluation system, for example, a backbone of the focus of teacher quality, has not been formed or agreed upon. And the success of many of the CBA's alleged huge steps forward are largely dependent on that infrastructure being good and solid. We have no way of knowing if that will happen. Unfortunately, the members of the committees who are charged with coming up with these various pieces of infrastructure are largely chosen by or approved by the union, meaning that there's a decent chance that the parts unveiled next spring will be weak. And one of the most troubling bits is a veto provision maintained by the union in the district that would override a school-wide vote to scrap the master contract. And the appeal process is decidedly lame. The union in our district would only have to defend the decision in front of the school board. That's it. So in the context of CBAs in general, I'm not really convinced that this contract is a huge step forward, especially in light of other strong contracts in other cities. But for the city of New Haven specifically, this contract is huge. Compared with Elm City's long-standing tradition of the most old school of old school union contracts, this is kind of momentous stuff. It's the first time the city can reconstitute schools or evaluate teachers based on data or even opt out of a master contract stipulation. Those pieces may be unformed, but they weren't even on the table before. So I'm going to give this one a B. Promising, but with a very, very long way to go. And we can only hope that the likes of Garth Harries, who's now the assistant superintendent in New Haven, and Alex Johnston, who is a Concan reformer and newly appointed member of the New Haven School Board, will nurse this young bud into a beautiful flower.
I gotta say, that was an informative rate that reform. I learned a lot.
Yeah, another way of saying it was it wasn't funny.
I'm sorry.
But it was...
Okay, so...
But I was...
I'm sorry, yes, but great, I'm so glad, yes. We learned about it. Let me ask you this, Stafford, Yaley 2007, was that right?
Eight.
All right, would you have done this story if we're not in New Haven, where your beloved Yale is located? Fess up. I'm just kidding. Yeah, look, that's fine. Stafford's done. You did your research on New Haven schools, right? You have a love for...
I do.
Reform there.
I've also been discussing this with various people who are on the inside of the conversation recently, so.
I gotta say, Mike, I mean, well, we've had a number about indecent exposure and buses. I think giving people a little bit of substance and that kind of thoughtful, crafted exposition, we should welcome
it. You're right. Anyways, you're right. This is a step up from...
Here's the thing. The other stories that one could have written about this week were, a teacher stabbed his child.
That's not funny.
900 students came down with the flu on the same day at one school.
That's impressive.
It was a 5,000 student school.
What was going on in that school?
Who knows? But that's not a reform. And it's just all the sort of like fluffy.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm not feeling very funny today, Mike.
That's all right, Stafford. That's okay. You give it your best shot. You'll come back with something funnier next week. Because, well, I'm just kidding. No, that was very important. Go New Haven. That's all the time we got for this week. We promise something funnier next week. Till then.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show here at edexcellence.net. Signing off.
We're digging the knife.